Welcome to the August 7th sidebar follow-up for episode 8. This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigation into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kessie. I'm Sean Gerd.
And I'm Scott Jamieson.
Today on the show, we are going to get to your emails, voicemails, and social media, of course. And you're also going to hear briefly from another friend of Jennifer's that we talked to after we'd already published episode 8. You also probably heard about the GoFundMe campaign that listeners have set up to benefit the Kessie family. We published a short 2-minute blurb about that on the podcast feed, so we encourage you to check that out. But before we get into the show, Scott and I have been looking for ways we can further and expand our investigation. You've heard us mention that over the last several weeks. And many of you have supported this on our Patreon, which has been extremely helpful. But today, we're excited because we found additional support in the form of sponsorship that's going to allow us to do some things that just wouldn't be possible otherwise. We encourage you in turn to support our sponsor because of what they're doing to support Unconcluded and our mission to find answers. This week's sidebar is sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country, and it's their mission to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. I want to tell you about some upcoming meals. Basil pesto chicken with summer vegetables, sautéed shrimp, green beans, and globe tomatoes, spinach, and orzo pasta, whole grain pasta with summer vegetables and heirloom tomato caprese salad, and also miso butter salmon, lo mein noodles, and cucumbers with charmed tomatoes. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron choose for you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, and you'll never get bored. And if you're a vegetarian, like my wife, you know finding meals at restaurants can be a challenge. So it was pretty exciting when we saw that each month Blue Apron offers vegetarian options as well. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, and the ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Blue Apron's guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, fresh, or they'll make it right. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/unconcluded. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/unconcluded. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And as I mentioned, by trying Blue Apron totally free, you're helping support the efforts of this show.
Okay, let's go ahead and get to the voicemails. We've got a few of those this week.
Hey there, it's Jessica from New York. I just want to say I really enjoyed the podcast. I've actually been binge listening this weekend, and as I'm walking my dog just now, a really creepy thought occurred to me, which is that if we go with the construction worker theory, has anyone looked into the possibility that perhaps she never left the complex and that her body or her remains are in some sort of renovated unit, and that was kind of how she was never found. Just curious, again, it kind of gives me the creeps to even say it out loud, but it was something I was thinking of, just taking into consideration the timing and all of that. So anyway, keep up the great work. Really enjoying it, and I hope we get some answers for her. Thanks.
Thanks, Jessica. This question's actually come up a few times since we started this show, and it all goes back to the renovation construction that was happening at Jennifer's condo at the time of her disappearance. Now, before I explain why we don't consider this a plausible scenario, I want to clarify what was going on at the Mosaic at Millennia at the time of Jennifer's disappearance. The condo building was in the final stages of being converted from apartments into condos, undergoing a facelift, if you will. So there was a lot of finishing type construction, paint and trim, carpeting and flooring, landscaping, that kind of thing. However, there was an apartment building under construction directly to the north of the Mosaic buildings. In fact, for those of you who have seen the photos online that claim to be of Mosaic at the time of Jennifer's disappearance, photos that show framing construction and unpaved parking lots, those aren't actually Mosaic. They're the neighboring apartments to the north. However, you can see the Mosaic buildings in the background of the photo, and it's misleading. Anyways, there was the kind of construction going on with cement loaders and framing and all of that, but it wasn't actually at Mosaic. However, it was nearby. The point of all of this is to say a couple things. To me, the idea of Jennifer being inside a wall just isn't realistic. And here's why. First, Mosaic's framing and walls were already complete. So she would have had to been moved to the neighboring complex for that to happen. And even if it did, the idea that a human body could go undetected for any length of time, without all the things that go along with a decomposing body, just doesn't make sense. And of course, we've also mentioned before that we don't consider a body being buried under concrete plausible in this case either. Every contractor we've spoken with, and there have been several, has said not only would there not have been enough concrete to conceal a human, is that even if there were, there would have been so many people involved, it's just, frankly, impossible. But it's taken us a while to come to that conclusion, and Jessica, just like you, when I first heard about this case, I thought about those same kind of things. So it was worth reviewing our reasoning behind our thoughts.
Hey, this is Alan from Phoenix, and I'm not entirely caught up. I just got done listening to the sidebar to do with the woman who said that she had come into the apartment looking for an apartment and also saw the fight in the evening. And here's what I wanted to point out. It was mentioned that this kind of puts the nighttime abduction scenario back on the table. And I would argue that it does not, based on the fact that all the evidence already looked at pointed towards the morning. And keep in mind that the surveillance video of the vehicle being moved is all in the daytime. And they would not do that if it happened at night. They would prefer to move the vehicle under the guise of the darkness to not be seen. So if they're doing it during the day, that guy is doing it during the day. It's because he has no other option because it just happened and he has to get taken care of then. If it happened at night, that would have been done long before the sun came up. Thanks.
On the surface, I think your suggestion makes sense. Why drop off a car in broad daylight when you could have done so at night? The problem is there's a couple basic assumptions that I'm not sure we're ready to make yet. First, that the POI was the actual abductor. And second, that whatever happened to Jennifer didn't take a very long time. Which both are quite possible, if not likely. However, let's say for example, the initial crime occurred in the late night or early morning hours. It's not a stretch that whatever actions took place would continue until daybreak. There's also other considerations as well. The car not being moved until later because it was somewhere that would have drawn attention to the perpetrator, or the popular idea that the person of interest was just paid to move the car later. So back to your original thought, I tend to agree with your thinking with the contingency that there are some other possibilities.
My theory is that someone came to her house the night before and they messed up her phone and, you know, all that. And then the next morning, they made it seem like she was there and then she left for work. That's it.
Thanks for your voicemail. This theory has been popular, actually, or at least theories that involve some element of staging Jennifer's condo. I consider myself a staging skeptic, simply because it seems like an incredibly risky thing to do, for the only apparent benefit being to suggest a morning abduction. Let's also consider the fact that there is no actual evidence to suggest staging. All that said, it can't be ruled out. And we do have the very tricky thing of the person of interest being tracked back to Jennifer's condo after leaving her car at the Huntington on the Green. But personally, I'm more inclined to believe this was to return to their own mode of transportation rather than stage a condo. But the good thing about all of you being along with us for this is my opinion or my thoughts aren't the only ones, and yours matter too. So together we can think through this and make decisions about how to move forward. And I think the idea of Jennifer's condo being staged is just one of those areas where we haven't come together as a group to decide just how we're going to move forward.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I'm calling from Charleston, South Carolina. And I just had a couple of things that I've just been a little bit stuck on, actually, from episode 2 with your conversation with Joyce, Jennifer's mom. And I just keep thinking about the fact that she said that the police were trying to convince them for the longest time that possibly Jennifer went out on Monday night late to try to find a FedEx to send overnight the phone of the house guest. And since the police are the only ones that actually know when the phone was powered down and the battery was removed, I just think it's curious that they were really trying to convince her that it was a possibility that she went somewhere on Monday night. And if that's true, if they know that the phone was powered down the night prior, that would change the timeline and probably, you know, lend some credibility to Erica's story. But I'm just curious. I mean, it's hard to then reconcile the wet towel and what her apartment looked like Tuesday morning. But what if, you know, she, all of the makeup and the clothes and the pajamas and the contacts were all from Monday morning when she'd gotten ready for work on Monday morning, and that those just had not been cleaned up yet, and possibly maybe the wet towel was used by whoever took her to help clean things up. I have no idea, because if they removed the battery from the house guest cell phone, then they were probably in her house. I can't imagine that unless it was the next morning when she was taking it with her on the way to work. So anyway, just some thoughts. I just keep really getting stuck on the fact that Jennifer's mom said that the police kept trying to convince them that that was a possibility, and I don't know why they would even go down that line of questioning or investigation if there was no reason to think that she was out the night prior. So those are just my thoughts. You guys are doing a great job, and I'm enjoying the podcast. Thanks so much.
This is still one of the biggest questions in the entire investigation, and I completely agree with you. The fact that the police initially seemed to be suggesting or questioning that Jennifer went out that night, January 23rd, along with the 10:40 p.m. time that's floated around the internet, that the cell phones were powered off and the battery removed, it gives you reason to believe that. But because we can't confirm it's true, and investigators have continued to leave their time frame open, we have to as well. I think that's the biggest takeaway from Joyce telling us that the time of 10:40 had never been told to her is basically that all of the options have to continue to be open. I can't imagine a scenario where the investigators wouldn't want to narrow down the time of Jennifer's abduction publicly, so we have to assume that they haven't done so themselves. And the last point I want to make before we move on is that, remember, Jennifer drove straight to work from Fort Lauderdale on Monday morning, so anything that was in her bathroom or her bathroom floor wouldn't have been able to be there for Monday morning because she wasn't at home that morning.
Now it's time for some emails and social media questions. Over the last few weeks, a lot of people have been wondering out there about the significance of the sweater, the men's size medium sweater that was found in Jennifer Kesey's clothes hamper at her condo.
Let me start by saying that I've never been told that it was a size medium, only that it was smaller than the size that her boyfriend would have wore. We've actually received multiple questions about the sweater. So I'm going to tell you what I know, which honestly isn't much. The people I've talked to remember it as such. The sweater was found a little later after Jennifer's disappearance. It was a navy V-neck lightweight sweater from Banana Republic. Her friends actually said that it wouldn't have been odd for Jennifer to have picked it up on her own on sale and worn it around the house and such, which is something I thought about the first time I heard about the sweater. In my opinion, it's something that has been sensationalized on the internet, when it has an easy explanation. Of course, no one knows for sure, so it's still a piece of the puzzle to be considered and not something that we just completely disregard. And right now, I do not know if it's ever been processed by police. However, the rest of Jennifer's condo wasn't, so I'd actually be surprised if it was.
Amy says, since Jennifer's apartment was not processed, can we also assume that the other apartments the workers were using were not processed? This seems like complete failure on law enforcement's part, as I truly feel one or more of them were involved.
Based on the information we have, many units at the Mosaic were searched by police, but not all of them. The condo across the hall from Jennifer, for example, the one that was unlocked and didn't have any carpeting, it was searched, but not on January 24th, at a later date, which tells me that even the units that were searched weren't in a timely manner. I don't have any details if there's any evidence, DNA, or fingerprints collected from the Mosaic, and units that were searched or not. But if you ask me to speculate, I'd say there's none.
Alyssa asks, really interested to learn more about her job. How did she describe her employment to her friends and family? Did she like her job, the company, her management? Has there been any suspicions surrounding the types of information she possibly would have had access to?
I haven't talked to anyone who said she complained about her work. In fact, several people have told me that she was good at her job and enjoyed doing it. But I'll be honest, I haven't had any conversations at length about that specifically. Now, there has been plenty of speculation surrounding her job and if she would have had access to information that may have been sensitive information that may have gotten her in danger. But there's no evidence at this point that that's the case.
Sandra asks if we've ever reached out to the detective to see if he or she would be willing to go on the podcast or at least answer some questions.
Yes, we've reached out to the lead detective on Jennifer's case. We did ask if she'd be willing to speak with us, if she'd be willing to come on the podcast or share any relevant information. Unfortunately, she declined to participate and directed us to the Orlando PD website for any information they were willing to release, which, as you probably know, isn't much. That said, I have passed along information to her, but it's very much a one-way street. I'm still hopeful at some point they may reconsider and provide additional details that could be relevant in the search for Jennifer.
Calla asks, did Jennifer have any work friends at her job? Perhaps they could offer some firsthand perspective into the dynamic between Jen and her male coworker.
We've spoken with a handful of people from Jennifer's job, none of which are willing to go on the record, and none of which would identify themselves as Jennifer's friends. We do have a couple tips based on these conversations that we're following up on, but really don't have anything to share at this time.
Here's a few questions from Courtney. Could Jennifer have made it to work or even close to work given how much gas was left in her tank? And here's the final question from Courtney. Since the Bloodhounds tracked the POI sent to the bottom of the stairs at the condo, does this mean that's where the POI stopped? Could he or she have gone up the stairs?
Based on what we know about the amount of gas that was in her car, I don't think it would have been possible for her to drive all the way to work that morning and then for the POI to bring the car all the way back to the Huntington on the Green. Of course, the gas consumption estimates aren't an exact science, but it's not something that we're currently considering. As for the POI going up the stairs, I do think it's possible. I've been told that bloodhounds can lose a scent for a number of reasons, and it's just possible that's where the scent was lost. However, that said, I do think that the POI may have just stopped there as indicated. Of course, if you're listening and you know more about this stuff than me, which isn't hard, please get in touch. We want to hear from you.
Katrina sent us an email with a few comments, and she says, this isn't a question, but a thought that may support a nighttime abduction. Jennifer drove back to Orlando from her boyfriend's house in South Florida and went directly to work. After work, she drove home, spoke on the phone with her family and boyfriend, and then presumably went to bed. But what if she left something in her car from the trip that she would have needed for bed, toothbrush, face wash, etc., and went back out to the car? Could something have happened at that point?
That's absolutely possible. In fact, based on what we've been told about Jennifer and how unlikely it would have been for her to go back out that night, if we're considering a nighttime abduction, then this would be one of the most likely scenarios, in my opinion. Running down to her car to grab something that she may have forgotten. In fact, we do know she hadn't brought up the DVD player that her boyfriend gave her because it was found in her car. So there very likely could have been other items that she hadn't brought up yet either.
In an email from John, he has a similar idea to Katrina's email, except his takes place in the morning. So he wonders if maybe she started to leave for work in the morning, forgot something in the apartment, maybe left the car running, went back into the apartment, and then came out. And that's possibly when the abduction might have occurred.
As you said, Scott, these are essentially the same scenarios, just at different times. This one I do find to be just a little bit less likely. because of the fact of what we've heard about Jennifer from others and how safety conscious she was. I'm not sure she'd leave her car running unattended while she went back inside, but is it possible? Sure. We could even speculate about the same scenario with her turning her car off and taking her keys with her. She'd probably need them to get back in her condo anyways. And maybe while she's doing this, someone's seeing her and awaiting her return. But ultimately, we just don't know, and it's a guessing game at this point. I mentioned earlier that we had an opportunity to catch up with another friend of Jennifer's, so we wanted to make sure that you had a chance to hear from her too. So let's go ahead and do that now, and then we'll wrap this up.
I think it was around junior year in high school. We might have had a class together, and there was another friend, Joy. So it was me, Jen, and Joy, and we just kind of hit it off. They were already friends before I joined their little group, but that's when we started first hanging out. Yes, she's just the type of friend that always puts her friends first, which, you know, is hard to find in people. She was never selfish. You know, she'd be the one to take the last piece of cake or the smallest piece, you know, and out of all my friends, I don't ever recall ever getting in any type of, like, argument with her. Like, she was just so easygoing and always listened to everybody's side of the story, just a great person. Definitely a safety-focused type person, you know. Like, I went on a trip once before cell phones, and she had a cell phone. She's like, take my phone, you know, just in case something goes wrong. I want you to have it so you're safe or I'll worry about you. So, you know, she was just a great person, great friend. Definitely missed, and she always was up for any trip we were going to go on. I went on my senior class trip with her to Cancun. Just hung out with her the whole time. She loved, I don't know, we went also to Las Vegas. I'm sure there was tons of other trips, but she was always down for anything fun, just easygoing. Everybody wanted to be around her. In high school, we would always go to her house. Her parents were younger, just so fun and open, and you can talk to anything with them about. And every year, her parents would have a big Christmas party, and we were both from Tampa, so we would, you know, we both went to UCF as well, and we're in the same sorority, so we would always come home for the same breaks, and I just feel like she was always a part of my life. And then, you know, we graduated from college. She stayed in Orlando. I went off to Georgia for pharmacy school, and so then kind of our time was cut short with each other. So I hadn't really seen her as much as I used to, which is kind of a blessing in my case, because to me, I'm just off, you know, away from Florida. And, you know, in my mind, I can pretend like she's still there. I would say we stayed in contact by phone, because I don't think I was on any type of social media back then. I postponed it for as long as I could. And I don't think she ever, I don't even know if Facebook was around. But yeah, just we had planned a trip to Las Vegas, like all of us from college. And that was, I think, the summer of 2005. So that was the last, you know, we had been apart for several years and we all planned this big trip to Las Vegas. And that was the last time I talked or saw her face to face. But I believe I talked to her in January of 2006, early on in the month. You know, we were kind of just catching up. It was the winter break for me. I was home from college. She was still in Orlando. And we were just filling each other in on our lives. And we were like, we all need to get together soon and plan another, you know, reunion type thing. And that was the last contact I had with her. I believe she told me about her boyfriend. Sounded like everything was going great. Just the usual, but she, you know, like I said earlier, she was always focused on safety, so she would never be the type that I would worry about, you know. If she ever had any concern, she would have let somebody know, you know, or, you know, done some kind of extra safety precaution. Yes, if she was concerned with her safety, she would have spoken up right away. But, you know, if she wasn't concerned, then she would have just carried on like normal. But being, you know, living by yourself, I think that would make you even extra precautious Because I could imagine her leaving her apartment, you know, like with her keys in her hands, focused on what she's going to do next, get into her car, you know? Like she would just be, she'd be prepared. She'd already have her keys ready to go, probably that key in her hand or the little click knob if it had automatic unlocks back then. Just ready to get in, lock the door, you know, just always on top of her surroundings. I came down the day after she went missing. It might have been before her car was found. I just remember my friend Carrie calling me, you know, the day she went missing, the afternoon or maybe early on, saying, you know, she's missing. They don't know where her car is. And I just couldn't believe it. And we just kept calling each other back and forth, like, kind of what's going on, you know, and has she been found? And I couldn't really concentrate on school, of course. And I just packed up the next day and headed to Orlando to her apartment where everyone was kind of gathered and her parents and just seeing her mom and dad and brother and then the girls from college, the other friends and family. And so handed out flyers, but I wasn't there too long. I don't remember police. I just remember everybody was anxious and just kind of sitting around waiting for the next bit of news, you know, just hopeful. But, you know, I remember her mom, like, had a picture of her and, you know, feel like she felt like she was still there, you know, like just hopeful. But, you know, distraught, of course. Everyone just seemed a little distraught and just, you know, knowing this is not like her. What in the world could have happened? Things like this don't happen in our lives, you know? This is more like a drama television show that we watch, you know, in college and things like that. Nothing that would ever we'd be living out. I just think it's great that you're keeping her story alive and just keeping everyone on the lookout for her or for anyone that saw anything or heard anything. I mean, somebody out there knows something about her, you know, and just pray that the leads keep coming in and just pray for this to be over, you know, for her to be found and brought home and to be with her family and friends where she deserves to be and for it not to go on however many years it's been, 11 more. But I'm thankful for the dreams I get periodically about her, and in my dreams she's always safe and sound and her normal self, so I do get to see her on occasion.
One thing that I did want to follow up with that Scott didn't mention is an email we received earlier in the week that just detailed how some of the witness accounts we've heard from so far seem to contradict each other. And certainly, that could be true. Keep in mind that we want to make sure we present to you these statements so that together, we can decide what they mean, if they mean anything at all. Scott and I are far from experts, but together, as a collective, as a group of thousands, we can tackle these issues and start to piece together the relevant parts. To that end, the last witness you heard that claimed she saw Jennifer at the Huntington on the Green on the afternoon of January 24th, 2006, she described seeing her with a ponytailed man. We've come to find out this isn't the only person who describes a similar man under strange circumstances at the time of Jennifer's disappearance. We'll get into that next week on Episode 9. As always, thanks to all of you out there who are along with us on this journey. Keep thinking, talking, and participating. And before we go, I want to make sure we give a shout out to our new Patreon supporters, Charles, Marianne, Colleen, and Tara. If you want to support this podcast, you can do that by visiting unconcluded.com and clicking support. But even more important than that, as you heard in the little listener request we published yesterday, please consider supporting the Kesey family with a one-time contribution to the GoFundMe that's been set up by listeners just like you. I've verified that all funds will go directly to the family, and we are already about halfway to our goal. Help us surpass that goal. Even just $1 makes a difference. Music in this episode is by Lee Rosevere. We'll see you next week.